What's new, listeners? I'm Audra Howell, the host of Two Cents Critic. If you're in the mood for reviews of books, movies, and TV shows, then join in. Today, though, we're not covering any of those. No reviews, no recaps, no, because we're talking to a filmmaker today. That filmmaker is Andrew Retter, the writer director behind the horror comedy short Peter the Penguin. And that was such a memorable short for me because when I was starting to watch horror shorts a few years ago, a couple years ago, I'd say, I was starting to go through the shorts, and then this one was one of the first few shorts that I came across, and I was looking some up. And so this was how I got introduced to Andrew's filmography here. So I'm very glad to have him on the show today. Say hi, Andy. What's up?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Again, that short stuck with me. When I ended up rewatching it in preparation for this convo, it was like, oh yeah, that short, it is still so damn bizarre and terrifying.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's definitely one of the weirder films that's out there.
Out of all of the short films I've seen specifically for horror, it is like, oh, that is just, wow, that goes into some peculiar territory, and I love it. But yeah, so what do you want to say just as a quick intro for our listeners? What do you want to say for yourself, Andy? Just a few words.
Yeah, sure. I'm a writer director. I'm based in the UK. I specialize mainly in horror and dark comedy. I've been doing a lot of short films for the last 5-6 years. And then I'm slowly now moving into feature films, very slowly. It's a long process, but hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah, definitely. Rooting for you. I'd love to see what you can do with a feature film. You've done some great work already in short films. I've seen I feel like that's always such an interesting tonal path to try to tread when you're doing horror and comedy, but also not just like horror comedy. It's just like a very specific, bizarre brand of dark comedy that you go for, where it's just like, it feels like you're watching something that's taking place on a whole nother plane of reality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of my sweet spot, really. That's what I love to play in when I'm making films. For me, the humor comes from the situational kind of awkwardness. You know, a lot of my previous short films have been based around weird social situations, and I think there's a lot of horror to be mined from those situations, to be honest. I mean, going this in Peter the Penguin in particular, it's a man who's going to meet his girlfriend's daughter for the first time. And, you know, situations like that carry a lot of anxiety just for everyone in their everyday lives. So it's not too far. It's not too much of a stretch to turn that into horror, really.
Oh yeah, it's something relatable, something we can link with real life. But then, as the short progresses, it goes into some very odd territory, creepy territory. And I do want to talk about that short more. But first off, and we'll circle back around to it. But first off, I want to go back through your life and ask you, what were you like as a kid? Do you think? To start off there,
I was quite quiet actually as a kid. I've got an older brother, you see, and he's the loud one. So I was very much more I was the kid who would just observe the situation, observe stuff, observe behaviors, and so I was quite a quiet kid, I think. And then I think growing up, my mom and dad had a camcorder, you know, and it was back then, I'm showing my age now, but back then it was tape. So we'd take the camcorder and we'd just like make our own films. And it's weird really, because we never saw it as a career. We saw it as just having fun with our friends. So I watched a lot of horror films as a kid. So in the UK, that it's the place is called car boot sales. Abroad, I think that's flea markets. But we'd go around and we'd find VHS, specifically horror VHS, and pick those up. And back then, it was like you'd have to take a bit of a risk, a gamble on a film, because you couldn't pull your phone out and look at the and look it up. You just have to look at the cover art and be like, okay, we'll take a chance on this. This looks great. And then you'd go home and it'd either be really crap or it might be great. But that's, you know, as a kid, horror was one of the genres that really spoke to me and my brother, because I think there's just a lot of creativity in horror, especially like the B movies we watched. You know, I think we watched a lot of Trauma, so The Toxic Avenger and that kind of stuff. And when you've got all these rubber puppets and all these, like, you know, stuff that we laugh at now, but it's like back then as a kid, it's kind of magical because it's really creative. And then, so we would look at that and then we would go with our friends and try and recreate some of these films. So one of them was The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was probably too young to watch, to be fair, but we watched it as kids and somehow came out okay. But we then went and recreated that with our friends. I don't think our friends had seen it, but they just went along with it and, you know, had fun. And so, yeah, so like that was childhood, really. It was just like imitating other films. And then as I got a little bit older, obviously you have to start thinking about life and paying bills and all that kind of stuff. But I never really thought I never really thought filmmaking was going to be a career, choice. I didn't even, as a kid, I didn't even know you could make money from film. I just thought it was a far away. I thought it was like this far away, distant thing in Hollywood that, you know, someone like me could never do, because I don't come from money. I don't come from, you know, connections. And where I'm from in England, it's nowhere near London. So it's like, it's very out the way where there's no film industry. So it was very a distant dream. And then I went to did college and university, and it was around about university where I basically started having to think about life and how do I make money. And that's when I basically picked up a camera and started learning. I mean, I've been playing with cameras before this, but I picked up a camera and decided to turn that into making money. So I was shooting corporate film and all that kind of boring stuff. So I wanted to stay within the industry, but to make money, I started doing like corporate video just to kind of fund the horror films I wanted to make.
Yeah, pay the bills. Got to have something to pay the bills, bring in the sex, the money.
Yeah,
and I guess you said, and then go for the passion projects.
Yeah, exactly. The money,
which, you know, it's realistic. You know, you got to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you brought up the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Again, definitely, like you said, like, oh, maybe a bit too young to watch that. But hey, you know what? Lots of kids do watch plenty of movies that aren't appropriate for them, especially horror movies. And that movie, specifically, I actually had seen just recently. Like, I think it was maybe a year ago or so that I saw it for the first time. Around that year ago. And yeah, that movie still holds up. It is actually quite terrifying. Like, wow, oh my goodness, the anxiety inducing.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece. I absolutely love it. It like you say, it still holds up and it's still got that raw terror.
And also, brilliant. not even that gory, surprisingly, considering like relatively not that gory.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's what you forget, because I was the same. I watched it as a kid, and then a few years go by and you seem to think it was gory, but then yeah, like you say, you watch it again, you're like, it's not at all. It's just the way they've done it. It you know, it's so effective and gets under your skin.
Oh yeah, it's horrifying. It's like I feel like especially towards the end, lots of the screaming and focusing on your eyes, those eye shots, and the cinematography, and just all the panic and fear. Like, it's still horrifying, even if it's not throwing a whole bunch of gore at you.
Absolutely. And I think like 70s kind of film is probably my favorite era of film, that the 70s. I think there's such I love the textures of the 70s.
That's like, a grain.
Great. Yeah, it's just like everything was grimy as well, like especially New York and London, both, you know, those cities are so grimy back then, but it's just so magical when you watch them on film.
Yeah,
everything's too clean now.
Clean, I know. Yeah, And then you had also mentioned camcorders and the VHS cassettes, which brings me back to those days of just of older technologies that I had been around for when I was little. Like, I specifically VHS, because when I was little, definitely I remember those. I even I think my mom still has like the VHS tapes of things like Toy Story. I know that, and then other movies as well, and just it's like it brings back some nostalgia, especially I feel like in this current day and age of physical media dying out, which is frustrating to watch.
Absolutely. I mean, I still love VHS. I don't really watch it as much, but I still have quite a few. Basically in the UK, the Video Nasties, like the notorious list, the DPP 72, you know, I started collecting a few of those during the pandemic, and I had a lot of time on my hands and some spare cash lying around, and I started buying some of the, you know, Driller Killer and what else we've got? I've got them over there. Cannibal Holocaust, you know, because for me, there's just something about physical media in general. I think it's being able to hold something in your hand, something that's tangible. And I'm not against streaming, and I'm not against streaming. But I think you lose part of the magic with streaming. I think maybe this is a nostalgic thing, I'm not sure, but I miss being able to go to the video shop and look at things on the shelves and be in awe at the covers and then pick one up. And then, you know, like I said earlier, just take that kind of risk on a film. But at the same time, they take up a lot of space but I still have a few, and I can't get rid of them because they're just so beautiful. Even the cover art alone they're just so beautiful. So yeah, I can't get rid of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like those VHS tapes in my home, I feel like I'll have to try to hold on to those for as long as possible. And definitely DVDs, quite a few DVDs, old DVDs. I think even just something that pops into my mind now is like the special edition of National Treasure. It's like it was a two disc special edition of National Treasure. It's just like goodies like that, or The Incredibles, also a two disc edition. Remember when they used to come out with two disc?
Yeah.
Movies.
Well, the thing is now there's it's funny where physical media is going, because especially in horror, you got these boutique labels. One that comes to mind is a company called Second Sight, and they do these really amazing, like, big boxes. I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, actually, I've got one, and I think it's like, I don't know how many discs it is, actually. I think it's like four discs, maybe. And it comes with like a book, and like an actual hardback book within the box. And it's like, they do these really amazing boutique, I mean, they cost a little bit, but they are absolutely beautiful. And it's weird how the physical media now has moved into like boutique specialist releases rather than, yeah, I don't know. It's really strange how it's all kind of moving at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, I mean, stuff like that, you know, I love hearing about that, like boutique editions, but still, like, you know, I would like some, like, I guess, like regular special editions, you know, like, again, like what I was talking about, like the two disc stuff, like, you know, you just pick up at a store, you know, for a few dollars, and I just have lots of love for that. And it's just like you were talking about just going to a store and picking up some movies, just going through the racks and the shelves. And it's a different experience with streaming services, though, because yes, you can go to the movies and find some stuff on there, but even then, it's like, oh yeah, you have to deal with the algorithm adjusting things, and of course, you also need to be able to afford a subscription for the streaming services. And it's just like, so different pluses, different minuses for these different formats. But still, it's just like, and then of course, you also have to take into account how the money, you can't measure the money easily with streaming. And how, like, that, and It's like, that's a whole issue with, like, the money for that, and for that, like, compared to the money at the box office, and how certain movies can't really get made today anymore because they don't make much at the box office. But it's just, like, and you can't.
It is, it's very strange. I mean, it's weird in a way because, like, there's some films can't get made, but then there's, like, strange films that, well, not strange films, but there's films that get made through these streamers that maybe wouldn't exist in another way. So it's kind of like a weird, it's a really strange time at the moment. And I think, like, what's even scarier is this whole, like, deleting films as well. And
yeah,
especially like the Coyote film that just got deleted.
I know. It's
really, like, strange.
That has been so aggravating to watch. Like, Warner Brothers, David Zaslav, what are you doing? Oh, my goodness.
It's just, I as a filmmaker myself, it's I can't even imagine spending all that time, you know, working on a project. I mean, that was a feature film as well, so they'd have spent, you know, best part of maybe 2 years possibly on this project, and then someone just goes, nah, gonna delete that, tax write off, whatever. It's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking.
I know it is. It's so anti-art, and you can also, it's like, it's that, or also, like, with Disney Plus, like, Disney Plus taking off some content, like, oh, the Mysterious Benedict Society, take off that whole series on Disney Plus, and that was a Disney Plus exclusive streaming series, and now it's gonna move from there. You can't stream it on there. If you want to watch it, you could sail to high seas if you want to, but if you want to watch it legally streaming it, you can't do it on Disney Plus.
Yeah, it's crazy, that is. I mean, they did that with I think it was Willow as well, didn't they?
Yes, Willow.
The Willow sequel series just
which is sad, because that was like a series that I actually enjoyed. I was like, oh, this is a prequel series that, wait, is actually pretty good. It's pretty entertaining. But then it's like, oh, no, they're going to cut that off. Not even just cancel it. They're going to remove it from the platform entirely.
I didn't even get to watch it because it got removed.
Oh.
Such a shame.
I hope that there can be a shift in this industry sometime soon in regards to how it's handling the streaming crap. Because these movies, these shows, this art needs to be treated better. Come on, you can't just...
Absolutely, it's a really strange time. I think no one's safe. No filmmaker is safe.
Okay, so I do want to ask about the VHS stuff. So, are there any other VHS cassettes that you have that you want to note?
I've got quite a few, to be fair, but I'm trying to think of how many I've got. I've got quite a few. I collected them because, like, basically during the pandemic, as a kid, I had these tapes, and then I held on to them for as long as I could. I lost quite a few. And then I just got down. I think, like, it started off with buying one tape originally on eBay, and it was Monster Squad. And I bought it just to, like, I thought, oh, that'll be a nice, like, just little thing to go on the shelf, and that's that. But then I bought that tape, and then that's when it started, the addiction. And I kind of went down a rabbit hole. I thought, oh, you know, maybe I'll just buy this one as well, just for old time's sake. And then it just never stopped. And then I ended up joining Facebook groups, which is where it really got serious, because the Facebook groups, you've got the hardcore collectors who have been around since, like, the 70s or whatever doing it. And I got in with them, and I was, you know, suddenly I was buying and trading on these Facebook groups. And then I curated quite a stash. I filled a whole wardrobe up at one point with tapes.
A wardrobe?
But these are all, yeah, absolutely. It was massive. And it was all mainly horror. I mean, I was only really buying horror tapes. But I then kind of got rid of a few, and I started curating it. And then I whittled it down, and I basically collect the called pre-cert, the pre-certification tapes. So they've got, in the UK at least, you've got like the 18 stickers and stuff, whereas the pre-certification was before that came into play around the Video Nasty era. So I've got quite a few now. I mean, Zombie Flesh Eaters is probably my favorite one. It's the nicest looking tape in my opinion. The artwork with the hand coming out the ground. That's probably my favorite tape.
When you were going through these movies, Did you have noticed if there was any particular, any traits they had? Like, were there any specific qualities where it's like, oh, if a cover has, like, this kind of art style on it or this specific element on it, any commonalities between these movies that you would pick up on? Like, oh, if this has it, I'm more inclined to pick it up.
I think it was more for me about the films themselves. I was, because I'd seen a lot of the films as a kid, and it was like kind of just reconnecting with those films through the tapes. So the way I think I could have become bankrupt if I'd have just listened to my indulgences and stuff. But no, I think, like, for me, artwork is a big factor, and I like the labels as well, like the cases. Some of these cases that they came in have got like embossed logos and stuff. And I know it sounds really boring, but there's some of the companies that were releasing these tapes during that time had these really cool logos and embossed cases. Sometimes you, even though the tape should have that case, a lot of people over the years swapped cases broke, so sometimes you didn't get the right case. I mean, I'm getting really into the the details here, but
we want.
Yeah, I can appreciate a good case. Case, I mean, condition as well. It's like tapes get moldy, and I hadn't like really realized this, because when I was a kid, I never experienced mold on tapes. And then obviously, you know, 20 years after I last bought a tape, they've all started to, it depending on where you keep tapes, they get moldy. And that was something I was learning about. And when I first started buying tapes again, I was cleaning tapes as well. This is how serious it got. I'd get a little screwdriver, and I'd start opening the tape case up, and I'd be cleaning the mold off the reel to try and save and salvage the tapes. Because some of these tapes now, they're worth a lot of money, which is crazy, really.
Yeah. And I wonder, about my own tapes, which I've boxed away somewhere. Do they have mold? Oh dear.
That's the thing. It's in the UK, it's the horror set always sells quite well, but like the pre-cert video nasties, they can go for silly money on eBay. Ooh. Like really silly money.
It's funny because I just feel like I can relate to that, just looking through movies, trying to pick the movies out, because when I go online, whether it's on like going on the internet or going on streaming services or going on Letterboxd, and sometimes it will be certain poster designs that pop out at me, and maybe especially like poster designs for maybe horror or thrillers or science fiction, stuff like that really pop out at me and then draw me in to look at the premises, the cast, and the crew, and just, you know, try to be like, oh, like if I'm going through these random little movies, looking in the dark corners, the shadows for something that's maybe underseen, underrated.
Yeah, it's hard to stand out as well. Like, especially now on streaming platforms, I think it's hard for, I mean, Netflix and all these other places are probably really good at making you and bringing attention to stuff, but they're also really good at burying films as well, which is unfortunate. And you know, sometimes,
and pushing movies in your face, like pushing, oh hey, here, watch The Gray Man, please.
Oh
watch
god this. Yeah. That's the thing. It's like I've found a film that I've been wanting to watch that I didn't realize was even on the platform, and I can't remember what the title was, but it was a fairly new film, and I didn't even realize it was on the platform because they just didn't really promote it. And it's mad, really. You know, they've got I mean, a lot of people complain that there's nothing good on Netflix, but there is, but it's all buried.
Yeah, some movies will just drop like that, like The Kitchen, which someone watched this, but The Kitchen dropped on Netflix with no fanfare, and it's like, I still need to watch this, but just like, Netflix, you really pump out the promo for some movies, for some media, but in others, you're just like, hey, let's just plunk this on a Sunday and no one will notice and no one will watch it because we don't talk about it.
Yeah, it's mad as well how much they spend on these films as well, and how little they promote them. I mean, I can't imagine being a filmmaker making a film for Netflix, because I mean, I wouldn't say no, but at the same time, it's I think I'd be a little sad.
The risks and challenges you have to keep in mind, you know.
Yeah, it's all about compromise, I think. And you know, I'm a big, I like, as we've been talking about, I'm a big sucker for physical media. So I'd really want my film to come out on Blu-ray or, you know, whatever. And I think the thought of it not being able to come out because it's on a streaming platform is a little bit sad, but these are the times, aren't they?
Well, we've been talking about physical media for a while now, but I do want to shift things over to talking about your work. And specifically, I want to focus on Peter the Penguin here, which is again the short film that I'd seen a while ago, and I was able to rewatch it, and again, still lots of love for it. And that short, oh, it is so creepy, so eerie. But first thing I gotta ask, where did you get that little lion toy? Can you tell us that? Where did you get the little lion?
Yeah, the lion toy. So my girlfriend, that is one of her childhood, I think they're called Beanie Babies, and I think it's a Beanie Baby, but yeah, that was hers as a child. So like a lot of the things we used in the film, a lot of the props, especially like the toy stuff, was sourced from like childhood storage. So I think I went up into her parents' attic and was just rooting through boxes, and we found like that little lion because she was a big fan of The Lion King. So that ended up, yeah, just kind of being brought into the film. And yeah, there's a lot of weird little props that we sort of found in different weird places.
And then what about the penguin? The penguin itself. Wait, was that so that was just was that made specifically for the short film, or was it sourced from somewhere else?
Yeah, so that was made for the short film. So the person who made that is a guy called Tom Ellis, and he's a really close friend of mine. And he kind of does a lot of this kind of stuff. Like he doesn't work in film all the time, but he kind of makes little kind of creatures and sculptures that he sells on an Etsy store. And but he loves cinema and he loves horror, and so it's a good excuse for me to just kind of rope him in. And I gave him a sort of loose guideline, but I wanted him just to kind of interpret it himself. And then he went away and kind of just started. He showed me like progress while he was making it, but I kind of left it to him. I gave him just some loose guidelines, and then he just went away, made it, and then came back, and then we dirted it up with like slime and blood and feathers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's the eyes especially for that penguin head really stand out to me. And even while watching the short, I just couldn't help but think, wait, are those like fake? Are those in the world of the short? Are they supposed to be fake guys, or did the characters get some human eyeballs for this?
That's the thing, yeah. It's I think I've got the eyeball still, you know, and I think I've got it in my drawer. Let me
Oh.
just see, because basically the head was going moldy, because I've still got the head.
Oh.
It's in the attic of my house, and so what I did was I plucked the eye off, thinking that that I'd have to throw the head away. But in the end, I didn't even throw the head away. I kept it. But
Oh.
like, I swear I've got it still. This is probably not the best time for me to be. Oh, there it is. So, there's the eye.
Oh, okay. Oh,
Obviously,
damn.
the listeners, if they won't be able to see it, but that is the. So it's just I've ripped it off the head, but it's a very like realistic looking
Can I
eye.
take like a picture of it? Can I take a picture of it?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I just
Because
hold it up.
it's not recording the video, so I can just
It's probably a little blurry, but
Oh, that's okay. Just Alrighty. Thank you. Yes, I got the pictures of this eyeball here. Wow.
I've still got the whole head, but yeah, so it was going moldy, because to give you a bit of context, I shot the film way back in 2018, so it's like a long time ago,
Oh,
and
damn.
then the film didn't come out until 2020. And then he did a festival run in 2021, or 2020, 2021, and a little bit of 2022. So it kind of had a delayed release. But all this time I kept the head because I just couldn't, I didn't have the heart to get rid of it. But I'm probably going to stick the eye back on, I think, soon, because it's not too moldy anymore now it's in my attic. So I'll stick the eye back on, and then it'll be back to back to normal.
Back to it's 4-4-1.
Yeah.
It's complete. Yeah. And now, what inspired you to go with this route specifically, a penguin? How did you get to this point for Peter the Penguin?
Yeah, so it's funny, actually, because when I was doing the festival circuit, a few people asked that question, actually, why a penguin? And for me, it wasn't like a deep choice, but it was, I wanted an animal that was really cute and disarming, and I love penguins. I'm not obsessed with penguins, but I do love penguins, and they're so clumsy and so funny to watch when you're watching it, like documentaries or YouTube videos. Like, they're always falling over or doing something. So for me, I wanted to take an animal that was quite innocent and then flip it into a horrible, twisted version of that animal. Because I think if I'd have done something like a lion or a tiger, or, you know, something that's more, a predator, it wouldn't have been, I think, as funny as well. That it's because a penguin just seemed, penguins are so sort of dopey and so silly in a way. They're very majestic as well, that's the thing, but I wanted to kind of ruin that for people and turn it into something horrendous.
Yes, horrendous, and just in a world of this sort where a lot of characters, as I said before, it feels like you're existing on a different plane of reality when you're watching Andrew's stuff, and I feel like that's definitely applied here, where a lot of characters, it's like they are existing on another plane of reality. Like, what are they doing? And they are taking this so seriously. And then they are pulling some grim shit. Oh my God.
Absolutely. I think for me, it's all about playing it seriously. And because I think that's where, for me, the humor kind of comes from as well. It's the fact that, you know, it's all played dead straight. And the fact that paramedics take it so seriously as well, it's so ridiculous. And it's a ridiculous concept. But I think if we'd have done it any other way, it wouldn't have worked. You know, if we'd have done it really jokey and wink-wink to the camera, it just completely would have been a load of crap. But it was all about just playing it dead straight and dead seriously, I think.
And this is something that happens in your other shorts as well. And another short I want to call out specifically is The Heritage, which also, I feel like, goes down the same path of bizarre shit happening, but there is a character, there's usually like a character or maybe two characters, but at least one character who gives the audience a perspective that they can sympathize with, where it's like a relatively more mundane perspective. Like, oh, they're on Earth with us. They're like, oh, wait, what the hell's going on here? So to watch those audience perspectives, then have to deal with all of the wild shit happening, and it just amps up the tension just that much more.
Absolutely, yeah. I think like The Heritage is sort of the spiritual big brother of Peter the Penguin, because The Heritage only exists because of Peter the Penguin. A little bit of backstory on The Heritage and how that came to be is because Peter the Penguin played at a festival called Beyond Fest. And one of the, like a Disney exec saw it at that festival. And they then reached out to me and asked me if I'd want to pitch for their new series called Bite Size Halloween. And then like, essentially The Heritage, I had the idea probably around the same time, or if not, just before Peter the Penguin, because it's probably like 10 years prior. So what tends to happen with my process is like, I'll have an idea, but if I don't have the money or the means to make it, I'll just store it away, and then just like when the time comes, I'll pull it back out and be like, ah, you know, here, I've got something. And so when they came knocking and there was like a really good budget, I just thought of The Heritage, and I was like, well, I'd never be able to make that film because of the prosthetics and everything that's involved. And, you know, this is the right time to do it. So, but at the same time, you know, that film structurally is probably very similar to Peter the Penguin as well, because they were originated around the same time, I think those ideas were. So like, yeah, it's like, it's weird. They've got such a link to that those two films have, but the budgets couldn't be any more different as well, because Peter the Penguin were made for like nothing. you know, it was just me and friends. There was no funding, whereas the Heritage was funded and had a studio involved, you know. So it's
what was that experience like? Can you give us more details on what that was like between these two different?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Pete the Penguin, I'd been making a lot of narrative music videos before then, so I'd already made a lot of short narrative stuff, but Pete the Penguin was kind of like my first proper narrative short film that wasn't a music video, essentially. And it was a bit, I wouldn't say a disaster, but it was very stressful on set because I guess I was still learning a lot at that point, and our crew was tiny. There was not many of us at all. And obviously, combine that with having no money, you're relying on favors and people to, you know, show up even though you can't pay them. But everyone was friends, and everyone was in it to make something, you know, together. We all had an agreement and an understanding, but it was tough. And I remember being really stressed. And but The Heritage was like a completely different experience, because I made a few more short films after Pete the Penguin, and then I got to The Heritage, and I felt really prepared. And the budget was a lot more, even though it was still tough, because we shot The Heritage in 2 days, just like Pete the Penguin. But The Heritage was a much more bigger project because of the prosthetics that we needed to achieve within the time frame. The crew was like 30 people or something ridiculous. So again, it was like more people, more, you know, people running around. But I prepared so much for The Heritage that when it came to shooting it, it was just like, it wasn't too stressful, because I felt really prepared. Whereas Pete the Penguin, even though it was a smaller project, I was less prepared, I think. I wasn't really sure. I had to learn on the job, basically, with Pete the Penguin, and make mistakes. And then luckily, by the time I got to The Heritage, I didn't need to make those mistakes.
Well, yeah, I feel like that's something that a lot of filmmakers, even just artists in general, you have these stages where you have to get over the hump. You have to polish your craft, and it's not going to all be smooth in the early portions of your journey, but you'll change, you'll grow.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully. That is quite a laudable marker for your career, though. I think, like, you have this, as sure as it is on Hulu, as part of this whole series, The Bite-Sized Halloween, which I hadn't actually seen any of the shorts for it, any of the episodes for it, before checking The Heritage out. So it was nice to just know that, hey, here's another source of a whole bunch of other, you know, short films to check out.
Yeah, there is some really good ones, especially in the earlier seasons. I think there's 3 seasons altogether. But, you know, sadly for me, like, because I'm in the UK, we don't have Hulu. So a lot of my friends, when they ask, oh, where can we see The Heritage? I'm like, well, you can't. Because, you know, you can't, unless you get a VPN and do all that kind of stuff, which most people can't be bothered to do. So it's one of them where I have to send private links out to people to just so they can see it. But yeah, it's a shame we don't have it in the UK, you know.
Oh, damn.
I mean, I've seen it too many times. I don't want to see it ever again, but I do, but not, yeah.
Wait, so that's right. So you don't have Hulu in the UK, but Disney Plus over there is kind of like the Hulu stand-in, would you say?
Yeah, so in the UK, the Disney Plus, they have the horror features that I think Hulu have, but we haven't got a lot of stuff that, as like, we haven't got the Bite-Sized Halloween series. I don't really know why or what the situation is. I'm guessing it's just literally licensing and stuff, and I'm guessing it comes down to all that. But I can't. A friend of mine was in America, and he took a picture of the TV and was like, I'm watching it on the TV. And I was like, that's cool, but I haven't been able to do it myself. So
it's funny, because I remember coming across a tweet recently that was like, hey, it's funny all the stuff you can watch on Disney Plus in the UK, and then the picture has things like Shogun is on Disney Plus in the UK, or I think the new Walking Dead show, and just how it's like, it's funny, like, compared to the UK version to the US version, and it's like, there's such a stark difference here.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I remember I used to use a VPN to go on the US Netflix, because they just had loads of, like, way better shows. on there, and then the UK was just like barren, had nothing.
VPNs, I've always heard about them. I don't have one, but I've always heard about them. And even like I've heard ads for them on podcasts.
Yeah, they're really popular, I think. I don't know too much about them, really, other than that I think it's just about changing your IP to, like, a, you know, a US IP, so it fools the website, I'm guessing. I should probably try it with the Hulu and join up.
Maybe. So you've been working on your short films for a while now, and again, you're trying to slowly make your way towards a feature film. Is there anyone in Hollywood with whom you'd love to work in the future? Anyone, whether it's an actor, director, writer, cinematographer, composer, just anyone, editor?
Wow, I mean, God, how long have you got? I mean, that's the thing. There's so many. I mean, like, I know there's some filmmakers who don't watch many films, and that, like, there's varying filmmakers who they're, I guess, like, have sort of different sort of palettes with how they intake media and stuff like that. But I'm a massive film nerd, and so, like, you know, there are a lot of people who are dead that I'd love to have worked with. Rick Mayall was one of them. He's a British actor who, he was, I guess, in the US he'd have been most, I don't really know how he's in the US, but he was in Drop Dead Fred, and then obviously he did the series Bottom and The Young Ones. I love Rick Mayall so much. I'd love to have worked with him. Obviously, I can't. He's dead. So I'm not starting well here, am I? I'm ticking dead people. But I don't. Yeah, it's hard because there are so many people I love. I know that's a cop-out answer, but there are so many, and not just like actors, but like, yeah, I guess directors I wouldn't work with, because I guess I don't know how it would work. But there's just like Sam Raimi, for instance, he's just so fantastic. I think he's such a great filmmaker. I mean, I don't love all of his films, I don't think, but I love him, and I love The Evil Dead. And I think I gravitate towards personalities as well, and characters. And I think, obviously, you never truly know what they're going to be like until you meet these people. But Sam Raimi would be a cool one. Who else? God.
Yeah. I still need to watch the third Evil Dead movie, but I've seen the first two, and you're fine.
Yeah, the second one's my favourite one, I think. And then Army of Darkness, the third one, just goes really, like, cartoony. But it's still great. It's still so much fun. But, like, and I know Sam Raimi supports, like up-and-coming filmmakers, and obviously that's how, I think, Lee Cronin did Evil Dead Rise, because he'd seen, I think, Lee's previous film.
I've seen Evil Dead Rise, and that was a good one, too.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and but yeah, I mean, as soon as I get off this chat, I'm sure a thousand names have come to me, but I've gone blank. But like, I guess, like, I don't know. It's hard, really. I mean, I just like, I want to work with really nice people. I hear so many horror stories about sets being like really kind of tense, and you know, like a DP might be really difficult to work with a director, and they don't get on, and then they have to make a whole film together even though they don't get along. And I heard that story just the other day. I can't say who it was, but like they've just done a really big film, and you know, and it's more that to me is horrifying. It yep, scares absolutely. The hell out of me to like absolutely. Yeah, and then like I'm sure I'll come across someone at some point who's going to be a total asshole, but films are just so like hard to make, and they take every ounce of energy from you and time as well, especially features. And you just want to be surrounded by like really good people. And I don't really have like, there's a few actors I think like I'd love to work with. I think, to be honest, there's probably hundreds of actors I'd love to work with. But
if you want to name a few names, hey, just like whatever, just to name a few names.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, God, I go black. I mean, Eddie Marsden's a good one. I think he's like,
oh yeah, that's a good one. Yeah,
he's great.
Even if he pops up in a small role, I have lots of love for him. It's like, hey, you know what? I'm glad I got to see you, even for a few minutes. You know,
Absolutely.
The movies I've recently seen him in are Operation Fortune, Lose the Gear. He's in that for a bit, but still, I love seeing him there. And then he's also in Fair Play on Netflix. And
yeah, he's really versatile.
Also, Prime Video to Power, which that's a good show, but he's also in that show.
He pops up a lot. I think he's really good in Ray Donovan as well. You know, he's got Parkinson's disease, I think, in that, and he's like always shaking, but he plays it so authentically, and you watch him for so long because it's like 7 seasons, and you just think he has got Parkinson's, and he's one of them that he can play a sweet character, or he can play someone so evil. But oh god, there's just so many actors. I mean, again, I am drawing a blank here.
I guess maybe, you know, maybe I made the field a bit too big. You know, maybe I made the field a bit too big, but. Still, a lot of people to potentially work with. I feel like I would say for one, I feel like someone I'd love to work with in the future, because as someone who inspired us to be a filmmaker, I'd love to work with Ludwig Göransson someday. You know, because I have a ton of love for his scores, especially Tenet. And that's a top notch pick right there, Tenet or Oppenheimer.
Oh yeah, the Oppenheimer score is just fantastic.
The Mandalorian. What he did for the Mandalorian, it's like, oh.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it's a good composers are like, actually, yeah, there's a few composers I would love to work with. I mean, Clint Mansell is great. Ooh. And obviously, and he passed away not too long back with Angelo Badalamenti. Obviously did most of like David Lynch's stuff. But
yeah,
again, I'm naming dead people. Yeah, I mean, composers, god, yeah, there's so many great composers. But it's like, I also love like the idea of just finding people who are like undiscovered and just kind of working with, and then like we make a name for ourselves with our own thing, and then like they become people to watch. I mean, that excites me quite a lot, is kind of working with a bunch of like people who are unknown, and then hopefully we do something really cool, and then suddenly they're like become something. But yeah, like, oh god, there's just it's so many cool people doing cool stuff.
Definitely. Well, I gotta ask you about your auto birthday cake that you had back in 2016, because you got a picture of this up on Instagram.
You've done your research.
Yep, I do some snooping for my interviews, so it's like I gotta ask you about the auto birthday cake now. what was happening here? Why is it auto specifically? Tell me, please.
So my girlfriend made that cake. So we'd just got together actually in 2016, and it's weird. Like, I'm sure a lot of couples do this, where, you know, every couple's got their like sort of in jokes and their sort of things that they latch onto and share together. And like, at the time, me and my girlfriend like love animals, but like we go through phases of like certain animals that we like more than, you know, the flavor of the month kind of thing. Like an otters were like, it's so ridiculous really, but otters were like something we were really like just finding a lot of joy in, I suppose. you know like on Instagram and Twitter, and you get all these reels and memes and stuff, and like you see a meme and they send it to someone, and like depending on which animal we're sort of like having a laugh with at the time, we'll send each other loads of like otter memes. And so like during that time, otters were what we were like finding really funny and cute, and so yeah, that's literally why she made an otter cake for me. And then we moved on to like hamsters. And then it's really silly. And I think at the moment we're getting a good laugh out of prairie dogs. We find those really funny.
Prairie dogs.
I mean, it's so trivial, but yeah, that's why she made the otter cake back then anyway.
That's good, yeah. You know, hey, you know what? Animal fixations, you know, I can appreciate that. And for otters specifically, I find otters be quite cute. I feel like when I think of otters, I always think of the otters who to have this habit of holding hands in the end of water in order to stay together, survive, stay attached. Yeah. When I see the pictures of them doing that, it's like, oh, you know, it warms up the part of my heart that loves cuteness.
Absolutely. And it's a good counterbalance to all the horror that I'm watching and kind of making as well. So yeah, I kind of need those nice cute animals.
Yes. Animals. to go along with the lions and the penguin and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess it's like evident in my work, you know, I'm obsessed.
And now I got to ask you about your favorite books, movies, and TV shows. Just favorite picks across all of these fields of media.
So what would be my favorite out of all of them, or what would be my favorite?
For each of them. So like favorite books, and then favorite movies, and then favorite TV shows.
Yeah, sure. Books, I do read a lot of autobiographies, and I've kind of like, I'm trying to move more into fiction and read a lot more fiction because there's so much out there. But something I read not too recent, was David Lynch's Room to Dream, which was absolutely amazing. Just great anecdotes, and it's such a weird structure in the book where the co-author would write a passage and then about David Lynch's life, and then he would write a passage kind of commenting on what she wrote and what's true and what's not true. And It was such a weird structure, and I'm such a massive David Lynch fan anyway, and I just loved the structure of how that was playing out, how she was writing like a more traditional biography, and then he would like write a chapter about what she wrote and going into detail and anecdotes.
That's intriguing. So, I like that.
Yeah, it's really cool. And he's got some amazing anecdotes, and you can't help but read it in his voice as well, because he's got such an amazing voice. So that, I wouldn't say it's my favorite book, but it's I find it hard to pick favorites with anything really, because it always changes. And but that was definitely like something recently that I think was really great. TV shows, wow, we're in the golden age of TV, or at least we were. And I mean, I've got a few. I'd say I probably won't be able to pick one, but The Sopranos is up there, I'd say. And this might, The Leftovers as well, I think that's probably really high up there.
I hear about that a lot. I hear about it.
The Leftovers is just absolutely amazing. And the score is absolutely just beautiful. And this might be a controversial one, but Lost is one of my favorite shows as well.
A show that I don't have yet to watch, but I hear a lot about that show, both good stuff and bad stuff about Lost, but I'll explore it someday.
But that's the thing. I mean, with Lost, I won't go off on too much on a tangent, but Lost has its flaws, and there's a lot of behind the scenes that affected the way the show kind of picks up pace and loses its pace, and the showrunners didn't know how many seasons they had, and it's all this kind of stuff that affects the storytelling. But ultimately, this Michael Giacchino's score, the characters, for me, it's all worthwhile. But the ending's divisive as well, but I liked it. I it did enough for me to. I'm not too judgmental when it comes to things I watch. I mean, it has to be really awful for me to like have a strong, harsh opinion on something, because I can watch something that is probably flawed, but as long as I enjoy maybe the characters or the atmosphere, or just the score, I can find some of the positives, I think, within that kind of whatever it is. Maybe it's the filmmaking thing that, like, I know how hard it is to make something. So it's like, because I find Twitter to be quite toxic for film.
Yeah.
People are just so quick to just shit on something. And I don't know. I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion. And I've had plenty of my fair share of bad feedback on my films. But like, that's the beauty of it all, I suppose. Everyone's different, and everyone's got different tastes, haven't they? So, but yeah, I'm going off on a tangent. But those I'm probably missing off so many good TV shows as well. But those ones come to mind, I think. And The Wire, I mean, that's probably a cliche now, but The Wire, I love The Wire. A lot of Americans, I like a lot of American TV, I suppose. I mean, I should mention a British one, actually. There's a good one called Life on Mars. And that, like, at the time, blew me away.
I don't think I've heard of that.
Yeah, so Life on Mars, it's British, but they did do an American adaptation, which failed, I think. It just completely flopped. But the British one's just really good. It's a guy has an accident, and he gets transported back to the 70s as a cop. And so he's, like, trapped in the 70s, and he doesn't know whether he's, like, dead or he's alive. He doesn't know what's what, so he's trying to get back into his present day from the 70s. It's just really good, really, really cool. And then I saw his movies. Now that's the hardest question for me, really. I mean, what I'm gonna just go on I'll name probably my top three-ish. Now, one of my favourite movies is probably a really weird choice, considering I love horror, but it's a film called Return to Oz. It's the 80s sequel to Wizard of Oz.
Return to Oz. Okay. Oh, that's a fascinating choice, an unusual choice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've actually got it tattooed on my my arm. That's TikTok there.
Oh, okay.
I have yet to see it. It's just amazing. I mean, it's one of those that, like, it wouldn't exist today. It's just this anomaly that kind of happened. And the 80s, kids' films could be much darker back then. So, like, Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, they were just that Jim Henson kind of vibe. And I loved kids' films that had that darkness to them, that weren't afraid to scare kids as well. Because I think that's, like, kind of important in growth. And but Return to Oz is just full of, like, great characters, and the music is, like, just jaw-droppingly beautiful and magical, and it's one of those films that I could watch till the end of time, and that's how I think I judge my favorite films. And to contrast that, one of my other favorite films is called An American Werewolf in London. So that's directed by John Landis, but it's American Werewolf in London is great because it's really scary, but it's also really, really funny, and it balances that humor and horror really well. And the werewolf in it's actually really good, and it's got one of the best transformation scenes in history when he first transforms into the werewolf, and you see it. It's just absolutely amazing. So the effects in that are really cool. Because I think it's because it relates to my own work, where I'm always trying to balance sometimes humor and horror, and that film does it really, really well. And it's just a great film. Like, it's just really good. So that's up there. And then I'd say The Thing is probably another one as well. I love The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing. It's probably for similar reasons to American Werewolf in London, even though it's probably not as funny. But it's, like, just so groundbreaking. The effects in that film and the atmosphere. It's so oppressive and just really cool. And again, I think my favorite films are always just based on, like, how much I rewatch them and like the craft of it, I suppose. But I think those three come to mind at the moment. There's hundreds and hundreds more, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for instance, and stuff like that. But those three films I can watch probably any time. Like, if it came on TV, I could just watch it and sit there and watch it.
Yeah. I feel like definitely, specifically, Return to Oz and An American Werewolf in London, those two, I feel like they definitely reflect your work, kind of like in terms of either being bizarre or it's a horror comedy. I feel like you're definitely shining a good light on the way that your own work has evolved with the tone of it all.
That's cool, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've actually got a really big poster as well of Return to Oz, like a big cinema poster.
Ooh,
it's, like, on the wall over there. But yeah, I'm obsessed with it. I actually got the actress who plays Dorothy. She's seen my tattoo and she commented on it. This is going back, like, I think it was Twitter. I sent her a picture and she was like, "Oh, that's amazing." And it was just, like, really cool for her to see it.
that's really neat. That's amazing. I love that. Well, you've got those picks, but now I'm wondering, is there anything that you love, any piece of media that you love, but you would find it difficult to recommend to other people? Anything that fits in that spot?
That's a good question. That I'd find difficult to recommend.
Yeah, to other people. Just for any reason at all, you find it difficult.
I know a lot of my friends are like sickos as well, to be honest. So it's hard to... I mean, I guess the only film that comes to mind that I probably wouldn't recommend, but I do appreciate the film, is Cannibal Holocaust. But it's just because, like, I don't love watching the film, to be honest, but I do love the craft of it. I love how effective that film is, but at the same time, there's, like, real animal cruelty in that film, which I don't stand by, and I find I can't even watch it. That part I have to fast forward. But, like, Cannibal Holocaust is probably the only example I can think of that I just wouldn't recommend anyone watching it. But saying that, it's like, of the time it was made and how it was made, I suppose, but it was so effective. And I saw it way too young. I was in high school when I first saw it, which is like just way too young. But it did, it had an effect on me. I mean, obviously it was so like horrifying, because even like the graphic scenes in that film, it just looked so real and so authentic. And obviously, because it's like one of the first ever found footage films, essentially. Oh, you know, this is pre Blair Witch and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like the director was doing something kind of ahead of his time. And I love the craft of that film. I love the music by the opening theme tune by composer Riz Ortolani. It's so haunting and so like beautiful. The music is, and then you've got this beautiful music, but then you've got this really horrific imagery. So I love it for like a lot of reasons, but then I would never probably recommend it to people just because of like, you know, the animal cruelty in there. And obviously it's just such a nasty film as well. It's such a mean spirited film to watch. So that's the only thing I can think of that like, I probably wouldn't recommend to people, to be honest.
Yeah, I feel like that's a very suitable answer, because even in my own group of film friends that I've got on Discord, one of my friends, I feel like maybe multiple of my friends have seen it, but I know at the very least one of them definitely saw it and absolutely loathed it.
Yeah, I get it, because it's like...
It's a movie that I'll be honest, I don't know if I'll ever watch in my life. I don't know. Like, it's there. I know it exists. I don't know if I'll ever be able to watch it. Yeah. But still, a very suitable answer here.
I think that's the thing. It's like, it depends who you're talking to as well. Like, I have recommended it to some people in the sense that they're interested in the history of film. And, you know, whether we like it or not, that's a film that does exist. And it did influence, you know, other films. I like Blair Witch, for instance, or whatever, and had ripples throughout the horror genre. But it's not a fun watch at all.
I'd be willing to watch The Human Centipede before watching Animal Holocaust.
Yeah, The Human Centipede is quite tame, I think, because I watched that and I just didn't think it was like that bad. I think they get worse. I think the second one's probably a lot worse. But the first one is actually, I thought it was quite slow, and just wasn't that like shocking to me. Because once you get past the actual setup and what, because you know the actual Human Centipede, like it's aside from that, there's not really much that goes on in that film that is that like shocking. It's more about the idea, I think, of that film and the kind of the myth, like the myth and the like about it. The people talking on the internet about it, that makes it scary. But like when you actually watch it, it's like, it's okay.
interesting. Okay. Well, we've been having quite a conversation here, a very enjoyable conversation here with you, Andy. And I want to thank you for that. And to wrap this up, I want to ask you now for your good word. This is something I always have on my podcast where we have a good word. This is a segment where you get to present some things that you want to recommend to listeners, whether it's a movie, a book, a TV show, a podcast, music, anything you want. So, Andrew, what is your good word?
So, I was thinking quite a lot about this, and I was trying to think about what I could recommend. And I ended up settling on a British TV show that was made, I think, around the year 2000. And there's only 6 episodes, which is quite common in British TV. We don't make much. Many seasons and episodes, and it's called Jam, and it's by Chris Morris. And you might know Chris Morris as the director of Four Lions, but he before that he did quite a few shows. He did one called Brass Eye, but Jam, and I the reason I bring up this TV show in particular is because this had a massive influence on Peter the Penguin, funnily enough, my short film. So I thought it was quite fitting, because Jam, even though there's only 6 episodes, it was so ahead of its time, because it's just super weird comedy sketches that are so surreal and so dark. I mean, some of them are absolutely, they are so bleak, but at the same time quite funny. And that, I think, is just, again, it speaks to me and my humor. Some people probably will maybe be offended by it, I don't know, but I think it was such an oddity. And I remember watching it for the first time and being absolutely blown away, because I hadn't seen anything like that before. And I didn't know that you could do things like that on TV, because I was so used to watching traditional comedy, I guess, like Only Fools and Horses and you know, that kind of stuff that you'd see. And Jam just kind of like rewrote everything and was just so bizarre and so weird. And, you know, some sketches, you wouldn't even know how to feel. You just like, you'd be like, what the hell was that? And I loved that feeling. And I, you know, maybe I think subconsciously I was probably trying to create that with Peter the Penguin as well, my film, and leave audiences feeling maybe a similar way. And yeah, and as a little bonus recommendation, another series called The Comic Strip Presents, because not many people seem to have heard of it. And even over here in the UK, when I talk about The Comic Strip Presents, some people are like, what's that? And it's like, I can't believe they haven't heard of it. And it's got all the greats from like the British comics, like Rick Mayall, Aid Edmondson, Dawn French, Jennifer Saunders, Alexis Sale. They're all involved, and Peter Richardson, who is like directing a lot of these. The Comic Strip Presents is just like, I think it's like 42 episodes, but they're all just short films. They're all essentially films, and they're all so weird and brilliant and strange and surreal and funny. And even Kate Bush appears in one of the episodes as well. She's back in, and this is like back in a, you know, the day, like 70s, 80s, I think. And yeah, I'd absolutely recommend anyone who loves the weird and wonderful and you know, comedy, to check out The Comic Strip Presents as well. So Jam and The Comic Strip Presents are my two recommendations.
Great, great. And then, like, it's good to hear about Jam specifically, because that you're saying, oh, it's like an inspiration for Peter the Penguin, which definitely, the way you describe it, it sounds very appropriate. And in general, Peter the Penguin was greatly inspired by apparently UK children's TV shows of late 80s and early 90s. And so to hear about that, and then now to hear about Jam, it's just like, oh yeah, that sounds very fitting. I love that. Love it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like one big melting pot of children's TV and Jam.
Yeah. Even like that, towards the end, there's that song. It's like a little, like a children's TV show jingle towards the end of the story.
Absolutely. That's actually Bodger and Badger. So I don't know if America got to see that show or not, but in the UK we had a children's TV show called Bodger and Badger, and we repurposed. So my sound designer and composer Simon Peacock, he recreated the score from the ground up. He rebuilt the instruments, and we basically just, it's like our cover version, but I changed the lyrics, and I got my girlfriend's drama kids, because she runs a drama academy, to sing the song for us, so, you know, sing our original lyrics. So I'm indebted to Bodger and Badger and the, you know, and the great people who made that show. But yeah, we repurposed it for our weird little film.
Oh, learning more about the details about Peter the Penguin. Oh my good lord. Well, again, Andrew, it was great to have you on, and always love chatting with filmmakers, learning about the arts, and now you get to promote yourself online. Where can people find you and your work, your short film?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to connect with me, I am on Instagram and Twitter as AJ Rutter. So it's just my initials and then my surname. So at AJ Rutter on Instagram and Twitter. I don't really use Facebook anymore, so I probably won't recommend that. And you can find my films. Where can you find my films? So you can find one on Hulu. So The Heritage is part of Bite Size Halloween. So it's season 3, episode 13. You can check that one out on there. And then Peter the Penguin is on YouTube, actually. So if you type in Peter the Penguin and then type in Alter, which is the horror YouTube channel. They're hosting the film, so you can watch it on there. And then I've got a website called andrewrutter.tv, and that's where you can probably find my other shorts that I made. But yeah, I think that's everywhere I am on the web.
Brilliant. And Otto, shout out to Otto, by the way, because that's where I've seen a lot of the horror shorts that I found.
Yeah, they do a lot. They seem to be on the pulse. They get them all in. They scoop up all the horror films.
Even just last week, I actually had an interview with a director, with a filmmaker who had his own short there. It's not about fear.
Amazing.
Kavon Josham. Had an interview with him, and that was a great talk too. So incredible.
Yeah, there's so many. They release. I don't know how often they release them, but I think it's quite often. But there's so many good films on there. It's an amazing resource for people who just love horror, you know, short films.
Yeah, find more short films. Find more filmmakers. Find more people who are like, oh, you know, this filmmaker has an eye. They got a style to vibe with. I have to keep an eye out for more of their work.
Yeah, that's the great thing about it. It's all about people seeing the work, isn't it? And I think Alta, you know, that's the beauty of it, is that they've got an audience. And so as soon as a filmmaker gets their work on there, it's such a great opportunity to get people watching it. I mean, at the same time, you know, my film also got stolen, but I guess the internet does what the internet does, and it reuploaded it on like TikTok, and then reuploaded it elsewhere and put their own they redubbed it, and like I had reaction videos as well, which I actually liked. I think that was really cool. People were reacting to it, and I even got fan art as well. I couldn't believe it. I had someone reach out because they'd seen it on there, and they did their own illustrations of the penguin, and I thought that was just absolutely amazing. Yeah, I think it was some little girl in some young girl in Australia. She'd seen it and then sent me some illustrations and animations she'd done. I was so touched by that, actually. I thought that was just amazing. but that's the beauty of the internet.
Oh, that's good. When you said like stolen from the internet, I was like, oh wait, what happened? Stealing from the internet? I don't know. But then I'm like, okay. Illustrations, that's good. Well, as for my socials, you can find this podcast on Twitter at 2_SenseCritic. You can also find it on Instagram at 2SenseCriticPod. And you can follow my personal accounts on Twitter, GoodPod, StoryGraph, Letterboxd, and TikTok at Arthur_Ant18. You can find me on Goodreads and Arthur Howell. If you want to email me, you can reach me at email 2SenseCritic@yahoo.com. You can also check out my blog at 2SenseCritic.com. And make sure you subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's on GoodPod, Spotify, iTunes, Overcast, Podcast Addict, all of those services. And make sure you do the ratings and reviews, especially because they help to spread the podcast, our shows, to more listeners, especially the indie podcast. Yes. And once again, Andy, thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's kind of surreal to talk with you here after, again, watching your shorts some time ago, a couple of years ago, I think, and then just now having you here. Yay!
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, and thank you very much for having me on. It's always good to chat and always meet new people as well, so thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And until next time, stay healthy and stay strong.